Tucker thought. How had that happened? He was almost certain he'd told Natalie about the twins, and he'd kind of assumed that Natalie would pass the news on to Lizzie. Obviously not. This was another example of something he should have done himself if he were any kind of father. The examples never stopped coming. They were inexhaustible. He would read up on parenting if he thought it would help, but his errors always seemed too basic for the manuals. Always tell your kids they have siblings. He couldn't imagine any child-raising guru taking the trouble to write that down. Maybe there was a gap in the market.
They're my brothers, said Jackson. Half-brothers, like you, me.
Cat had kids from another relationship?
Said Lizzie. Even this piece of tangential information was clearly irritating, something she apparently had a right to know. And if she was irritated about Cat having kids she didn't know about, Tucker was guessing that she'd be even more ticked off when she found out they were his. Or was he doing her a disservice? Maybe she'd just be really happy that she had more siblings than she'd suspected. More siblings equals more fun, right?
No, said Tucker.
So...
Tucker didn't want her to work it out for herself. He wanted to be able to say that he'd told her, even if he'd ended up breaking the news 12 years after the event. Jesse and Cooper are mine.
Yours?
Yep, twin boys.
When?
Oh, a few years ago now. They're 12. Lizzie shook her head bitterly. I thought you knew, said Tucker.
No, said Lizzie. If I knew, I promise you, I wouldn't pretend not to know. What would be the point of that?
You'd like them, said Jackson confidently.
I did. But don't play them at any DS game. They will destroy you.
Jesus Christ, said Lizzie.
I know, right? Said Jackson.
And they've been out to stay?
Just one time so far, said Tucker.
So I'm just another one on the conveyor belt?
Yeah. You have to be out by tomorrow, otherwise the next one bumps into you and you cause a pileup. I've lost kids like that before.
You think it's something to joke about?
No, I'm sorry, Lizzie.
I should hope so. You really are unbelievable, Tucker.
Lizzie's mother had somehow been reduced in Tucker's memory to the beautiful picture that Richard Avedon took of her in 82 for some cosmetic ad, picture that Tucker still had somewhere. He'd somehow mislaid Natalie's obtuseness, her haughtiness, her fragility, and her extraordinary humorlessness. How had he forgotten any of that? Seeing as those four qualities went half of the way toward explaining why they had split before Lizzie was even born. Half was generous, he thought. But seeing as he'd split with many, many women who possessed none of these faults, logic suggested that he should take some of the blame. And why hadn't he ever had a thing for warm Texan waitresses? Why had a chilly English girl seemed so compelling? Natalie was supposed to be his Julie Beatty replacement. He'd met her at a time in his life when he was a drunk, drifting from one party to the next simply because he was still being invited to parties. He was beginning to suspect that the invitations would be withdrawn one day, and the models, too. So Natalie had been his last hurrah. Not, of course, that she'd ever have made a noise as coarsely enthusiastic as that.
Guys, let's not argue. Hey, Lizzie, said Jackson brightly. Do you eat meat?
No,
said Lizzie. I haven't touched it since I was your age. It makes me feel sick, and I find the whole industry morally repugnant.
But you eat chicken, right?
Tucker laughed. Lizzie didn't. When Cat heard the truck pull into the driveway, she opened the screen door and stood on the porch, restraining Pomus so he didn't jump all over their guest. Tucker looked at her, trying to gauge her mood. She hadn't been a whole lot of use during the twins' visit, but that was mostly to do with their mother.
Tucker had told Kat soon after they'd got together that his breakup with Carrie had been difficult for him, and he had a vague recollection of implying that the difficulty derived from missing the excellence of the sex. He was surprised that this news pained her. He'd have thought that she might be consoled to hear that some relationships were hard to shrug off, that he didn't just plow through them all unharmed. Tucker carried Lizzie's bag into the house and introduced the girls to each other. For a moment they all stood there, frozen and smiling, although Lizzie's smile was a thin-lipped, functional thing that didn't indicate too much warmth or pleasure. Kat wasn't a girl anymore, Tucker realized now that there was an actual girl in the house. Life had got at her around the eyes and the mouth, and maybe even the middle. He was no longer an old pervert. Kat was a woman. But, on the other hand, he and Jackson had ruined her. She'd misspent her youth on them, and they'd repaid her by making her look worried and old. He suddenly wanted to hold her and say sorry, but right now, moments after a guest daughter had arrived, probably wasn't the time.
"Go sit in the backyard," said Kat. "I'll bring out drinks."
They walked through the house, Jackson pointing out places of historical and cultural interest, spots where he'd hurt himself, drawings he'd done along the way. Lizzie appeared underwhelmed.
"I thought you lived on a farm," she said when they were settled on chairs and benches.
"Why did you think that?" said Tucker.
"I read it on Wikipedia."
Did you read about yourself there, or Jackson?"
"No, it said you were rumored to have one child with Julie Beatty."
"So why would you believe them when they tell you I live on a farm? Anyway, you have my phone number and my email address. Why didn't you just ask me where I lived?"
"It seemed like too weird a question to ask my own father. Maybe you should write your own Wikipedia page so your children know something about you." "We have animals," said Jackson defensively. "Chickens, Pomus, one rabbit that died."
The rabbit had been recommended to them as a way to assuage Jackson's fears about the imminent death of his father. Tucker couldn't remember precisely how the idea was supposed to work. Maybe that the kid would learn about the natural order of things by looking after a pet over its own natural lifespan, was that it? It made sense at the time, but the rabbit died after 2 days. And now Jackson talked about his dead rabbit all the time. It was true, however, that he seemed slightly more phlegmatic about the end of Tucker's life, expected any day now.
"The rabbit's buried just over there,"
Jackson told Lizzie, pointing at the wooden cross on the edge of the lawn. "Dad's going next to him, aren't you, Dad?" "Yep," said Tucker, "but not yet."
"Soon, though," said Jackson. "Maybe when I'm 7?
"After that," said Tucker.
"Well, maybe,"
said Jackson doubtfully, as if the point of the conversation was to console Tucker.
"Is your mom dead yet, Lizzie?"
"No,"
said Lizzie.
"Is she well?"
Tucker asked.
"She's very well, thank you for asking," said Lizzie.
"Was there acid in there?"
"Probably."
"She was the one who thought I should come to see you."
"Oh, okay," said Tucker.
"It's that thing," said Lizzie.
"Uh-huh. This thing, that thing. They all turned out to be the same thing, more or less, so why insist on a definition?"
"When you find out you're going to have a kid of your own, you want to understand more about everything else."
"Sure."
"You guessed, didn't you?"
"What?"
"What I just said."
He got the feeling that there had been some information given to him that he hadn't processed properly yet. Maybe he shouldn't treat these getting-to-know-you conversations as a genre.
"Hold on," said Jackson. "That means you're my sister, right?"
"Half-sister."
"So I'm going to be... what does that mean?"
"You're going to be an uncle."
"Cool."
"And he's going to be a granddad."
Tucker finally understood what he was being told when Jackson burst into tears and went running to find his mother. Finally, Lizzie thawed a little, at least on the side nearest Jackson, when Tucker led him back a couple of minutes later.
"It doesn't mean your dad's old," she said. "He's not." Okay, so how many other kids at my school have dads who are granddads?
I'm sure not many.
None, said Jackson. Not one.
Jack, we've been through this, said Tucker. I'm 55. You're 6. I'm going to live a long time. You'll be a big man before I'm ready to go. 40, maybe. You'll be sick of me.
Tucker wouldn't want to bet on the lifespan he was predicting for himself. 30 years of smoking, 10 years of alcohol dependence. He'd be amazed if he even got his 70 years and 10.
You don't know I'll be 40, said Jackson. You might die tomorrow.
I'm not going to.
You might?
Tucker always got sidetracked by the logic in these conversations.
Yes, I might die tomorrow, he wanted to say. But that was true even before you found out I was going to be a grandfather. Instead of embarking on paths like these, however, he just had to talk rubbish. Rubbish always worked.
I can't.
Jackson looked at him, hope renewed.
Really?
Nope. If there's nothing wrong with me today, I can't die tomorrow. There's just not enough time.
What about a car crash?
Which anyone of any age could have at any time, you moron.
Nope.
Why not?
Because we're not going anywhere in the car tomorrow.
The day after?
Or the day after.
How will we get food?
We have a ton of food. Tucker didn't want to be thinking about whether they'd be starved out if they couldn't drive anywhere. He wanted to think about how old he was, and how he was going to die soon, and how his whole life seemed to have slipped away without him noticing. A while back, Tucker had promised himself that he'd sit down with a piece of paper and try to account for the last couple of decades. He'd write the years down in sequence on the left-hand side, and write down one or two words next to each, words that would at least give some sense of what might have occupied him in those 12 months. The word booze and a few ditto marks would do for the end of the '80s. Occasionally he'd picked up a guitar or a ballpoint, but mostly he'd just watched TV and poured scotch down his throat until he blacked out. There were other, healthier words he could use later on. Painting. Cooper and Jesse. Cat. Jackson. But actually, even they didn't explain away as many months as he'd be asking them to. How long had he really spent in that tiny apartment he'd rented and used as a studio in the painting years? 6 months? And his sons, in the years they were born. He'd taken them for walks, sure, but a lot of the time they'd been nursing or sleeping, and he'd watched them do both. But then, watching was an activity, right? You couldn't do much else if you were watching. Occasionally, he thought about what his father would have written if faced with a sheet of paper containing a list of all his adult years. He'd had a long, productive life. 3 kids, a good, strong marriage, his own dry cleaning business. So what would he write next to, say, 1961 to 1968? Work? That one short word would cover 7 years of his life perfectly adequately. And Tucker knew for sure what he'd have chosen for 1980. Europe. Or probably, Europe! He'd waited a long time to go back, and he'd loved every second of it. And the holiday of a lifetime lasted a month. 4 weeks out of the 52. Tucker wasn't trying to flatten out the differences. He knew his dad was the better man. But anyone trying to account for their days in this way was going to wonder where they'd all gone, what had been missed. Jackson was tearful for the rest of the afternoon and early evening. He cried about losing to Lizzie at tic-tac-toe. He cried about having his hair washed. He cried about Tucker dying. He cried about not being allowed to smother his ice cream in chocolate sauce. Tucker and Kat had presumed that he'd stay up and eat with them, but he was so exhausted by his emotional exertion that he ended up going to bed early. Seconds after the boy fell asleep, Tucker realized he'd been using him as a small but effective hostage. Nobody could get a clear shot in while Jackson was around. When he went downstairs and rejoined Kat and Lizzie in the garden, he was just in time to hear Kat saying wryly, "Well, he'll do that to you." "Who'll do what to who?" he said cheerfully.
"Lizzie was just telling me about her mom being hospitalized after you dumped her."
"Oh. You never told me about that. It just never came up when we started dating."
"Funny, huh?"
"Not really," said Lizzie. And they took on from there. Cat decided that she already felt comfortable enough around her new stepdaughter to give her a candid assessment of the state of her marriage. Lizzie reciprocated with a candid assessment of the damage Tucker had caused through his absence. She held her stomach protectively all the way through her complaint, Tucker noticed, as if he were about to attack her unborn child with a knife at any moment. Tucker nodded sagely at various points and occasionally shook his head sympathetically. Every now and again, when both women simply stared at him, he'd shrug and stare at the ground. There didn't seem an awful lot of point in attempting to defend himself. In any way, he wasn't absolutely sure what line of defense he would have taken. There were a couple of errors of fact embedded in the stories they told each other, but nothing worth correcting. Who really cared that, in her bitterness and rage, Natalie had told Lizzie that he'd slept with another woman in her apartment, for example? It was only the location she had wrong, not the act of infidelity itself. The only word that would have explained anything most of the time was drunk. He could have said that at regular intervals, possibly even after every sentence, but it almost certainly wouldn't have helped. At the end of the evening, he showed Lizzie to her room and wished her good night.
"Was that all okay?" she said, and she made a face as if he'd spent the evening dealing with acute heartburn.
"Oh, yeah, fine. You were owed."
"I hope you sort things out with Kat. She's lovely."
"Yeah, thanks. Good night. Sleep well." Tucker went back downstairs, but Kat had gone. She had used his absence as an excuse to go to bed without him and without explanations. They mostly slept in separate rooms now, but they were at a peculiar stage in their relationship where this wasn't accepted as a given. They talked about it every night. Or it got mentioned, at least.
"Are you okay in the spare room?"
Kat would say, and Tucker would shrug and nod. A couple of times, after a really savage argument that seemed to push them to the point of no return, he'd followed her into the bedroom, and eventually they'd swung things around. There was no talking about it tonight, though. She just vanished. Tucker went to bed, read a little, turned the light out, but he couldn't sleep. "It isn't you, really, is it?" that woman had asked, and he started to phrase answers to the question in his head. Eventually, he got up and went downstairs to the computer. Annie was going to get more than she'd bargained for.
Chapter 5. From Tucker. Alfred Mantellini at yonderhorizon.com. Subject: Ray, Ray, your review. "Dear Annie, it really is me, although I can't think of a good way of proving it to you. How about this? Nothing happened to me in a restroom in Minneapolis. Or this: I don't have a secret love child with Julie Beatty. Or this: I stopped recording altogether after I made the album Juliet, so I don't have 200 albums worth of material locked away in a shed. Nor do I regularly release material under an assumed name. Does that help? Probably not, unless you're sane enough to believe that the truth about anyone is disappointing, the truth about me, especially so. This is due to an unfortunate turn of events. The longer I spent doing nothing at all, aside from watching TV and drinking, the more a small but impressively imaginative number of people seemed to be convinced that I was doing a whole procession of outlandish things. Making hip-hop albums with Lauryn Hill in Colorado, for example, or making a movie with Steve Ditko in Los Angeles. I wish I knew Lauryn Hill and or Steve Ditko because I admire both of them greatly, and because I'd make myself some money somehow, but I don't. The fact is, some of these myths are so colorful that they have deterred me from re-entering the world. It seems to me that people were having more fun with me gone
than they could ever have if I was around. Can you imagine if I were to give an interview, for example, to the kind of music magazine still interested in someone like me? No, I didn't. No, I haven't. No, we weren't. It would be so dull as to be unconvincing. Anyone can say they haven't done anything. Today I learned that I'm going to be a grandfather. As I don't really know the pregnant daughter in question, I don't really know 4 of my 5 children, by the way, I was not able to feel joyful. For me, the only real emotional content of the news was the symbolism, what it said about me. I don't feel bad about that particularly. There's no point in pretending to feel joy when someone you don't know very well tells you she's pregnant, although I suppose I do feel bad that various decisions I've made and avoided have reduced my daughter to the status of a stranger. Anyway, the symbolism. Learning that I was about to become a grandfather felt like reading my own obituary, and what I read made me feel really sad. I haven't done much with whatever talents I was given, whatever your friends on the website think, nor have I been very successful in other areas of my life. The children I never see are products of relationships I messed up through my indolence and my drinking. The child I do see, my beloved 6-year-old son Jackson, is the product of a relationship that I'm in the process of messing up. His mother has been supporting me for a few years now, so I owe her a lot, but understandably I have begun to irritate her, and her irritation makes me grouchy and defensive. She thought that our relationship might work because we are different. And though it's true that she is practical and financially astute, she is a wholesaler of organic produce and can enjoy lengthy business meetings with people who care about money and fruit. These qualities have turned out to be of little use to us when it comes to getting along. I don't value them as much as I should, and in any case, my impracticality is no longer allied with my ability to write songs, since I no longer write songs. The artistic temperament is particularly unhelpful if it is just that, with no end product. I must confess to being as confused as I ever have been when it comes to the subject of compatibility. I have tried to live with women whose sensibility is similar to mine, with predictably disastrous consequences. But the opposite route seems every bit as hopeless. We get together with people because they're the same or because they're different, and in the end, we split with them for exactly the same reasons. I'm coming to the conclusion that I need a woman who admires fecklessness and indolence in a man, whether that woman is the CEO of a Wall Street investment firm or a graffiti artist makes no difference to me. I had completely forgotten about the existence of those Juliet demos until a few months ago when somebody I used to know found them on a shelf somewhere. He was the one who arranged to release them on CD, but I didn't mind, even though I agree with every word you said about their crudity. I worked and worked on the official versions of those songs, and so did my band, and the idea that a person with ears could listen to those 2 sets of recordings and decide that the shitty, sketchy one is better than the one we sweated blood over is baffling to me. To be honest, I would drop every single one of that guy's bootleg collection, all the 127 albums he foolishly boasts about owning, on his head, and ban him from listening to music ever again. But the release of Naked was a way of reminding myself that I was once capable of some kind of action. And in any case, I was given a small advance, which I was able to hand straight over to my wife. For an afternoon, I almost felt like a man bringing home the bacon for his family. I have given you too much information, I suspect, but I don't see that you can seriously doubt whether I am me. I am very much me, and today I'm very much wishing I wasn't. With best wishes, Tucker Crowe.
Tucker's reply was waiting for Annie when she arrived at work. She could have checked her email on her home computer before breakfast, and of course she'd been excited enough to have wanted to. But if there had been a reply, there was a chance that Duncan might have seen it, and easily the best thing in her life at the moment was her secret. It had been the best thing even yesterday, when all she'd received were two functional but still amazing messages that gave very little away. But now she had information that Duncan would have regarded as the key to unlocking the mysteries of the universe. She didn't want him to have that key for all sorts of reasons, most of them ignoble. She read the email twice, three times, and then went to get her coffee early. She needed to think. Or rather, she needed to stop thinking about the stuff she was thinking about, if she were to have a chance of thinking about anything else today. And what she was thinking about, more than Tucker Crowe and his complicated life even, was how Naked had poisoned the air that she breathed in her home. The night before, Duncan had come home late and smelling of drink. He was monosyllabic, curt even, when she'd asked him about his day. He'd fallen asleep quickly, but she had lain awake, listening to him snoring and not liking him. Everyone disliked their partners at some time or another, she knew that. But she'd spent her hours in the dark wondering whether she'd ever liked him. Would it really have been so much worse to spend those years alone? Why did there have to be someone else in the room while she was eating, watching TV, sleeping? A partner was supposed to be some mark of success. Anyone who shared a bed with someone on a nightly basis had proved herself capable in some way, no? Of something. But her relationship now seemed to her to be token failure, not success. She and Duncan had ended up together because they were the last two people to be picked for a sports team, and she felt she was better at sports than that.
"Hello, gorgeous," said Franco, the man in the coffee bar.
"Hello," she said. "Usual, please." Would he have said, "Hello, gorgeous," if she were bad at sports, as it were? Or was she reading too much into a cheesy greeting from a man who probably said it 20 times a day? "How many times a day do you say that?" she said, as a matter of interest.
"Honestly?"
"Honestly."
"Only once."
She laughed, and he looked mock hurt.
"You don't see who comes in here," said Franco. "I could say, hello, gorgeous, to people who look like my mother or my grandmother. I used to, but it feels wrong. So I keep it for you, my youngest customer."
His youngest customer. Was everything an accident of geography? She could believe it about this town. Franco wouldn't have said what he said if his coffee bar were in London or Manchester. She wouldn't have sleepwalked through 15 years with Duncan if she lived in Birmingham or Edinburgh. Ghoulness was the wind and the sea and the old, and the smell of fried food that somehow clung on even when nobody seemed to be frying anything. The ice cream kiosks that seemed to be boarded up even when there were people around. And there was the past. There was 1964 and the Rolling Stones and the dead shark and the happy vacationers. Somebody had to live there. It might as well be her. On the way back to the office, she realized that it was Thursday, and Thursday was the day that Moira worked at the front desk. Moira was a friend of the museum who was convinced that Annie's childlessness was the result of some lack, a lack that could be cured. She was right, probably, but not in the way she thought. There had been absolutely no conversation prior to Moira's intervention, which had apparently been prompted entirely by Annie's age, rather than by any longing that she had articulated to this woman she didn't actually know. Annie hated Thursdays. Today, it was celery. Moira, a sprightly octogenarian with a fine head of purple-tinged hair, was standing there waiting for her with a big bunch.
"Hello," said Annie.
"The leaves are what you want. What he wants, anyway."
"Thank you."
"Have you got a blender?"
"I think so."
"Just whiz the leaves up in that and make him drink it."
"Nothing for me? No tea or seeds or fruit dipped in milk?"
"Well, he tried everything for you, so it must be him."
Technically, Moira was right. It was him. He wore a condom. "I'll try it tonight."
"If you try it tonight, you have to try everything, if you see what I mean. Down in one and upstairs."
"I'll try it Saturday night, then." Oh, dear God, why on earth was she giving this woman information about their sexual timetable?
"Oh,
always a Saturday night man, Lizzie.
I should get on with some work.
Nothing to be ashamed of.
I'm not ashamed. But of course she was. She was ashamed of the implied monotony, and she was ashamed of her inability to tell the meddling old crone where to get off.
Oh, Alan, hello. We don't see you in here very often.
Moira was addressing a man in his 70s, who appeared to be wearing both an overcoat and a raincoat, as well as two or maybe even three scarves. He was clutching a jam jar containing what looked like a rotting pickled onion swimming in murky vinegar.
Someone said you're interested in the shark.
We are, said Moira firmly. Very.
I've got his eye.
From Annie Platt, annie@annieandduncan.net. Subject, Beyond Reasonable Doubt. It's you. I read enough fiction to know it's detail that makes a story seem real, and anyone who has gone to all the trouble of making that lot up deserves a reply anyway. And if it's not you, I don't really care, to be honest. I'm having an email conversation with an interesting and thoughtful man who lives a long way away, so where's the harm? I suppose there's another way of looking at this, which is that you're a lunatic, and all your children and grandchildren are simply the product of the damaged mind. If it turns out that you're a lunatic I might actually know, then I swear to God I will kill you. But please ignore that if you're not. And I'm proceeding on the basis that it's you. As you have probably worked out, I know people who think a lot of your work, and who think a lot about you. I have thought about you sometimes, but not that often, until relatively recently. Your name cropped up once or twice on a trip I took recently. And your new album, Juliet Naked, or rather the response to it that a couple of over-enthusiastic fans had, got me thinking more about you and about Juliet than I'd ever done before. I have never written anything like that before either, but the two albums helped me to see some things that I suspect I've always thought about art and the people who consume it ravenously, but which weren't quite in focus. Of course, there are a lot of things I would like to ask you about your missing two decades, but you probably don't want to be interviewed. I'm sure that if you put any two random strangers in a room together and got them to talk about their lives, all sorts of patterns and themes and opposites would emerge, to the extent that it would look as though they hadn't been chosen randomly at all. For example, you have too many children who you don't know, and it's making you unhappy. I have none, and I don't think I will have any, and that's making me unhappy. More so than I would have believed possible 3 or 4 years ago. So all the time I've spent with the man that I'm not having children with is beginning to look like all the time you've spent drinking and not making albums. Neither of us will get that time back. And yet, agonizingly, it's not quite too late either. Do you ever think that? I hope you do. I'm writing this from my office, which is in a small seaside museum in a small town in the northern half of England. I am supposed to be preparing an exhibition about the summer of 1964 in this town, but we don't have very much to exhibit, apart from some rather unpleasant photos of a dead shark that got washed up on the beach that year. And, as of this morning, an eye that apparently belonged to the shark once upon a time. A couple of hours ago, a man came into the museum with something, very possibly a shark's eye, floating in vinegar in a jam jar. The man claimed his brother had cut it out of the shark with a penknife. So far, it's our prize exhibit. You wouldn't like to write a concept album about the summer of 1964 in a small English seaside town, would you? Although it still wouldn't give me much to show. She stopped typing. If she'd been using pen and paper, she would have screwed the paper up in disgust. But there wasn't a satisfying equivalent with email, seeing as everything was designed to stop you making a mistake. She needed a fuck-it key, something that made a satisfying kaboom noise when you thumped it. What was she doing? She'd just received communication from a recluse, a man who had been hiding from the world for 20-odd years, and she was telling him about the shark's eye in a jam jar. Did he really want to know about that? And what about her need to have a child? Why not tell someone else? A friend, say. Or even Duncan, who, as far as she knew, was unaware of her unhappiness. And she was flirting. in her own reserved and complicated way. She wanted him to like her. How else to explain the circumlocutions about the Tucker tour of America and her relationship with people who think a lot of his work? It would have been much simpler to say that the man she lived with, the man she wasn't having babies with, was a Tucker Crowe obsessive. But she didn't want Tucker to know that. Why not? Did she think he was going to jump on a plane and impregnate her unless he found out what kind of a person she lived with? Even if they embarked on a passionate affair, she could imagine it would be difficult to persuade Tucker not to take precautions, given the unwieldy and unhappy family he already had. Oh, God! Even the self-directed sarcasm was pathetic. It still involved jokes about contraceptive arrangements with a man she had never met. But if she didn't write about Shark's Eyes, what was she going to tell him? He'd read everything she had to say about his work, and she couldn't just bombard him with questions. She sensed that would be a good way of never hearing from him again. She was the wrong person to engage in an email correspondence with Tucker Crowe. She didn't know enough, she didn't do enough. She wouldn't reply. She was supposed to be composing a delicate letter to Terry Jackson, the town councillor, who had the stupid idea for the 1964 exhibition in the first place. But she couldn't concentrate. She reopened the email to Tucker. Where did Juliet come from, do you know? Have you read Chronicles, Bob Dylan's autobiography? There's a bit in there where someone, a producer maybe, tells him that they need a song like Masters of War. Was it that one? To finish the album off. This is in the 80s when he was recording. But she couldn't remember the name of the album either. And she couldn't remember what Dylan said when the producer, whose name she couldn't remember, asked Dylan for a song like the song she couldn't remember, to finish off whatever the album was. She deleted what might have been an interesting line of inquiry. Duncan would know it all, of course, and Duncan should be the one writing to Tucker, except that Tucker wouldn't want to hear from him. And, of course, she still hadn't told Duncan about what she'd found in her inbox, and she didn't want to, either. She didn't need to know anything about Dylan, she realized eventually. She was just using a book to make her point for her, the way academics do. Where did Juliet come from, do you know? And what happens to those places? Do they just get overgrown, or might you stumble across them one day? I'm sorry if that seems too nosy, and I've just promised myself that I wouldn't bombard you with questions. If you want to see any photos of my dead shark, just shout. That seems to be all I have to offer in return. By the way, when I got home last night, I started reading Nicholas Nickleby in your honour. Was that last line too creepy? Bad luck if it was. It was true, anyway. This time, she clicked on Send before she could change her mind.
Chapter 6. It was okay, Duncan thought, that he and Annie had never been in love. Theirs had been an arranged marriage, and it had functioned perfectly well. Friends had matched up their interests and temperaments carefully, and they got it right. He'd never once felt itchy, in the way that two connecting pieces of a jigsaw never felt itchy, as far as one could tell. If one were to imagine, for the sake of argument, that jigsaw pieces had thoughts and feelings, then it was possible to imagine them saying to themselves, "I'm going to stay here. Where else would I go?" And if another jigsaw piece came along, offering its tabs and blanks enticingly in an attempt to lure one of the pieces away, it would be easy to resist temptation. "Look," the object of the seducer's admiration would say, "you're a piece of a phone booth, and I'm the face of Mary Queen of Scots. We just wouldn't look right together." And that would be that. He was now beginning to wonder whether the jigsaw was the correct metaphor for relationships between men and women after all. It didn't take account of the sheer stubbornness of human beings, their determination to affix themselves to one another, even if they didn't fit. They didn't care about jutting off at weird angles, and they didn't care about phone booths and Mary Queen of Scots. They were motivated not by seamless and sensible matching, but by eyes, mouths, smiles, minds, breasts and chests and bottoms, wit, kindness, charm, romantic history and all sorts of other things that made straight edges impossible to achieve. And jigsaw pieces were not known for their passion, really, either. People could be passionate about jigsaws, but the jigsaws themselves were orderly. Passionless, even, you could say. And it seemed to Duncan that passion was a part of being human. He valued it in his music and his books and his TV shows. Tucker Crowe was passionate, Tony Soprano too. But he had never really valued it in his own life. And maybe now he was paying the price by falling in love at an inopportune time. Later he wondered whether Juliet Naked had done something to him, woken him up, shaken some part of him that had gone numb. He'd certainly been more emotional in the days since he first heard it, prone to sudden lurches in the stomach and the occasional inexplicable prickle of tears. Gina was a new staff member at the Advanced Performing Arts Program, teaching pimply and deluded teenagers that they would never, ever be famous, or at least not in their chosen fields, although Duncan harbored the suspicion that some of them were insane enough to stalk and eventually murder somebody they idolized. Gina was a singer, an actor, a dancer, and though she still harbored dreams of doing some of those things professionally, life had worn all of the dreaminess off her. The people who worked in Advanced Performing Arts were freakishly young-looking middle-aged men and women, always waiting for phone calls that never came from touring theatre companies and agents. But if Gina still blew on those hopes to keep them glowing gently, she did it outside college hours. And she didn't talk about herself all the time either, despite having spiky hennaed hair and a lot of chunky jewellery. She sat next to him on a coffee break on her second day, asked him questions, listened to his answers, proved herself to be knowledgeable about some of the things that were important to him. The day after, when she asked whether she could borrow the first season of The Wire and told him that she'd taken the job to get away from a terminally ill relationship, he knew he was in trouble. 2 days after that, he was wondering what happened when a jigsaw piece told his interlocking friend that he wanted to join a different puzzle altogether. And also, less whimsically, he was wondering what sex with Gina would be like and whether he'd ever find out. He'd made very few friends on the staff, mostly because he regarded his colleagues as uncultured bores, even the ones who taught arts courses. And they in turn thought he was a weirdo, forever chasing up some obscure tributary of the mainstream to get to the source of whatever he happened to be interested in that week. They thought he was faddish, but in Duncan's opinion that was because their tastes were set like concrete, and if the next Dylan came to perform for them in the staff room, they'd roll their eyes and continue to look for new jobs in the Education Guardian. Duncan hated them, and that was partly why he'd fallen so hard for Gina, who seemed to recognize that major works of art were being created every day. She was going to be his soulmate, and in a town like this, with its cold grey sea and its bingo halls and its shivering senior citizens, soulmates came along every couple of 100 years, probably. How was it possible not to think about sex in those circumstances? They went out for a drink on the day he took season one of The Wire into work with him, hidden inside a newspaper and then placed in his satchel so that Annie wouldn't see what he was up to. Of course, it was only the secrecy of the acts that would have given her any idea, so presumably the smuggling was for his benefit rather than hers, a way of investing a mundane loan with the faintest scent of adultery. He called Annie to tell her he was going to be late getting home, but she too was still at work, and she didn't seem to be troubled by or even curious about his whereabouts. She'd been weird the last few days. He wouldn't be at all surprised if she'd met someone too. Wouldn't that be perfect? Although he wouldn't want her to leave until he had worked out whether this thing with Gina had potential, and it was early days as yet, seeing as they hadn't actually been on a date. They cycled, at Duncan's insistence, to a quiet pub on the other side of town, on the other side of the docks, away from students and staff. She drank cider, a choice Duncan admired, although he was in that frame of mind where anything she ordered, white wine, Bailey's and Coke, would have demonstrated her sophistication and exotic singularity. A pint of cider suddenly seemed like the drink he'd been wanting all his life. "So, cheers. Welcome aboard." "Thank you." They took a big pull of their drinks, made appreciative lip-smacking sounds, indicating A, that they'd earned this drink, and B, that they didn't really know what to say to each other. "Oh, so..." He delved into his bag and produced the box set. "Here it is." "Great. What's it like? I mean, what other programs is it like?" "Nothing, really. That's what's so great about it. It sort of breaks all the rules. It's a one-off, unique." "Like me," she laughed. But Duncan saw the opportunity to inject some early sincerity into the occasion. "I think that's right," he said. "I mean, obviously there are loads of ways in which, you know, you're different from, well, from an American TV series about Baltimore's underclass. It's actually about lots of other things too, but all the other things it's about doesn't make it more like you, if you see what I mean, so I won't go into them. This wasn't coming out right, but he was going to plough on anyway. But in some important ways, you're the same. Really? Go on, I'm very curious. She looked amused, rather than appalled. Perhaps he could get away with this. Well, I've only just met you, but when you were sitting in the staff room earlier today, he just wanted to pay her a compliment, tell her that he found her attractive, that he was glad she'd come to teach at the college, but now he was stuck with this stupid wire thing. Well, you stuck out like a sore thumb, in a good way, not a sore thumb way. Everyone else is so staid and bitter, and you lit the place up. You're cheerful and energetic and pretty and... Okay, the wire isn't cheerful or pretty, but when you look at all the other programs around, well, you just have to look at it, and you. He thought he got away with it, just about. Thank you. I hope you won't end up disappointed. Oh, I won't. The terminally ill relationship that Gina had left behind in Manchester was with a choreographer who idolized his mother and hadn't touched her in 2 years or said anything kind to her in 3. He was almost certainly gay and hated Gina for failing to cure him of his attraction to other men. What she most wanted in the world was a kind, attentive man who clearly found her attractive. Sometimes you can see car crashes from a long way off if the road is straight and both vehicles are heading toward each other in the same lane. Gina vaguely remembered Tucker Crowe, but she was happy to be educated. The day after their drink, Duncan played her naked and dressed, back to back, on her iPod, in her small and heartbreakingly underfurnished one-bedroom apartment up the hill at the back of the town, away from the sea and from Annie. And they went to bed together shortly afterward when she'd said exactly the right things about the rawness and unadorned simplicity of naked. To Duncan, anyway, it was sex that felt like sex too, something needy and alarmingly uncontrollable, rather than something that happened on Saturdays after he and Annie had rented a DVD. 48 excruciating hours after that, in the Indian restaurant round the corner, he was telling Annie that he'd met somebody else. She was calm when he told her. Right, she said. And by met, I presume we're talking about something more than meeting. Yes. You've slept with her? Yes. Duncan was sweating, and his heart was racing. He felt sick. 15 years, or more even. Was it really possible simply to jump from the belly of a 15-year relationship into the clear blue sky? Was it allowed? Or would he and Annie be made to attend courses, to see counsellors, to go away together for a year or two and explore what had gone wrong? But who would make them? Nobody, that's who. And there was alarmingly little tying him down. He was one of the first people to complain about the increasing encroachment of the state into personal lives, but actually, shouldn't there be a little more encroachment when it came to things like this? Where was the protective fence or the safety net? They made it hard for you to jump off bridges or to smoke, to own a gun, to become a gynecologist. So how come they let you walk out on a stable, functioning relationship? They shouldn't. If this didn't work out, he could see himself become a homeless, jobless alcoholic within a year. And that would be worse for his health than a packet of Marlboros. I should qualify that. Yes, I've slept with her, as you say, but it may well have been a mistake. Can I ask you, do you find this very upsetting? Because I have to say I do. I didn't really think it through. So why are you telling me about it? Would it have been an option for you, me not telling you? It's a choice that's rather difficult to offer, though, isn't it? It was an option for you, but you can't really ask me whether I want to know whether you've slept with someone else or not. I'd have smelled a rat. Unless I'd asked you when I hadn't slept with someone else, I suppose, if I'd asked you right at the beginning and then kept asking. Duncan! He jumped. She hardly ever shouted. Yes, sorry, I got sidetracked. Are you telling me you want out? I don't know. I did know, but now I don't. It suddenly seems like a big thing to say. And it didn't earlier on. Not as big as it should have done, no. Who are you sleeping with? It's not... I wouldn't use the present continuous. There's been an incident. So who have you slept with is probably the question. Or with whom did this possibly one-off incident take place? Annie was looking at him as if she might kill him with her cutlery. She's a new colleague at work. Right. She waited, and he began to babble. Well, I was just very attracted to her immediately. Still nothing. It's been a long time, in fact, since I've been as drawn to somebody as I am to her. Silence, but of a deeper and altogether more menacing quality. And she loved naked. I played it to her last... Oh, for Christ's sake! Sorry. He knew he should apologize, but he wasn't entirely sure what for. It wasn't that he was innocent of all charges, or even that he felt he had any kind of defense. It was just that he was no longer sure how many offenses he'd committed. Annie's irritation at the mention of naked, was that because he'd played it to Gina, or because she'd liked it when Annie hadn't? I do not want to talk about Tucker fucking Crow in the middle of this. So that was probably it. He shouldn't have mentioned Tucker at all. He could see that. Sorry, again. For the first time in a couple of minutes, Duncan found the courage to look at Annie's eyes. There was an awful lot to be said for familiarity, if you thought about it. It was an extremely underrated virtue, ignorable until the very moment that you were in danger of losing whatever or whoever it was that was familiar. A house, a view, a partner. This was all ridiculous. He would have to extricate himself from the other situation. Surely with the henna and the clunky jewellery, Gina must be used to one-night stands. Oh, that sounded terrible. He didn't mean that. He just meant that she must have moved in circles where the one-night stand didn't seem particularly shocking. She'd been in touring musicals, for God's sake. He'd just ignore the whole thing, pretend it hadn't happened, and avoid her during coffee breaks. "I'm not moving out of my home," said Annie. "No, of course not. Nobody's asking you to." "Good, as long as that's clear." "Completely." "So, what's reasonable?"
"What's reasonable about what?"
"Tomorrow. What's happening tomorrow?" He hoped that she was talking about a social arrangement he'd forgotten. He hoped that normal life was reasserting itself and they could put this misfortune behind them. "You're moving out," said Annie. "Oh, well, no, that's not what I'm talking about," said Duncan. "It may not be, but that's what I'm talking about. Duncan, I have just wasted half my life with you. What was left of my youth, in fact. I'm not going to waste another day." She picked up her bag, drew out a £10 note, threw it on the table, and walked out.
Chapter 7. "And how do you feel about that?" "I feel shitty, Malcolm. How do you think I feel?" "Define that word." "Like shit." "You can do better than that, Annie. You're an articulate young woman, and I'll put 10 pence in that swear box for you." "Please don't." "I'll let you off the first one, but the second was gratuitous. I don't think it's a good idea to break rules, whatever the circumstances." Malcolm fumbled around in his pocket, found a coin, and put it in the novelty piggy bank he kept on the bookshelf behind his head. The piggy bank was designed to spin the coin around and around before it came to its final resting place, so for the next minute or so, there was silence. Neither of them wanted to speak until the spinning had stopped. It seemed to take even longer than usual for the reassuring clink indicating that this 10 pence had joined the others, all of them representing oaths uttered by Annie in extremis, none of them anything that would shock a 10-year-old. A few months before, Annie had told Roz that, out of all her dysfunctional relationships, it was the one with Malcolm that caused her the most anxiety. Until the Friday night curry, Duncan hadn't been particularly troublesome. She only spoke to her mother for 15 minutes a week and saw her rarely since she'd gone to live in Devon. But Malcolm... Malcolm she saw every Saturday morning, for a whole hour, and every time she'd raised the subject of not seeing him every Saturday morning, or at any other time, he'd become visibly distressed. Whenever Annie thought about leaving town and her job for Manchester or London or Barcelona, the Malcolmlessness of these places came up embarrassingly early in the fantasy. After the absence of Duncan, probably, but sooner than the attractions of food or weather or culture. Malcolm was her therapist. She'd seen a business card on the bulletin board in the health centre when she first started to become depressed about childlessness, but almost immediately she'd known that Malcolm wasn't right. He was too nervous, too old, too easily shocked, even by Annie, who never did anything to shock anybody. When she tried to tell him that he wasn't right for her, however, he had begged her to reconsider and had dropped his fee from £30 an hour to 15 and then, finally, to 5. It turned out that Annie was his first and only client. He'd taken early retirement from the civil service to train. It had been his ambition for more than a decade. He would learn quickly. He was the only serious therapist in Gulenus anyway. He'd never find anyone as interesting or as sensitive as her. Annie simply hadn't the heart or the necessary steel to walk away, and she'd been enduring the spinning coins for 2 years now. She'd refused to entertain the notion of the swear box, which was why it was always Malcolm's 10-pence pieces that got spun. Why he was so committed to the swear box at all, she had no real idea. "Why are you so committed to the swear box?" "We're here to talk about you." "But don't you ever watch TV? People say that word all the time." "I watch television. I just don't watch those programs. People don't seem to feel the need to swear on Antiques Roadshow." "You see, Malcolm, that's exactly the sort of remark that makes me think we're not right for each other."
"What? Me saying that people don't swear on the programs I watch?"
"But you have such a prissy way of saying it."
"I'm sorry. I'm trying to learn to be less prissy."
He said it quietly and humbly and with a perceptibly self-flagellating tone. Annie felt terrible, as she often did when talking to Malcolm about nothing much. This was why she eventually ended up giving in, telling him the sort of things she was supposed to share with her therapist, stuff about her parents and her hapless love life. It took them away from the depressing, awkward small talk. "Humiliated," she said suddenly.
"Sorry?"
"You were asking me to do better in my description of how I'm feeling. I feel humiliated."
"Of course you do."
"Angry with myself as well as him."
"Because?"
"Because this was always going to happen. He was going to meet someone, or I was going to meet someone, and that would be it. So I should have got out ages ago. It was just inertia. And now I've been dumped on." Malcolm went quiet. Annie knew that this was a technique analysts were supposed to use. If they waited long enough, then the person undergoing analysis would eventually shout out, "I slept with my father," and everyone could go home. She also knew that with Malcolm, the reverse was true. If Annie waited for long enough, he would fill his own silences by saying something stupid, and they would argue. Sometimes they spent the entire 50 minutes arguing, which at least made the time go quickly. Malcolm's interjections carried with them no disadvantage that Annie could see, as long as she succeeded in sloughing off the irritation of their inanity.
"It's funny, you know, with your generation."
It was all Annie could do to stop herself from licking her lips in anticipation of the fuddy-duddy provocation that was almost bound to follow an introduction like that. "What is, Malcolm?"
"Well, lots of people I know have an unhappy or frustrating marriage. Or a boring one."
"And?"
"You see, they're quite content, really."
"They're happy in their misery?"
"They put up with it, yes."
Never before had Malcolm so neatly summarized the absurd paradox of his ambition, Annie felt. He was an Englishman of a certain age and class, from a certain part of the country, and Englishmen like him believed that there was almost nothing too grim to be endured. To complain was to show weakness, so things got worse and worse and people became more and more stoical. And yet, counselling was nothing without complaint. That was the basis of it, really, airing dissatisfactions and hurts in the hope that something